So this past Tuesday, we completed a six-week study of Jeffrey Kripal's book, Comparing Religions, Coming to Terms. But even over those 6 weeks, we couldn't get all 500 pages of that college textbook, you know, into six 75-minute sessions, and I'm certainly not going to try to cram it all into 20 minutes. I talk fast, but I don't talk that fast. But I would like to share with you some of the highlights of Kripal's conclusions about where we find ourselves on the other side of the comparative process. So having compared the world's religions in light of all we know from the best of modern science, as well as in our own direct experience. In particular, I'd like to focus on Kripal's final chapter, Reflexive Rereadings, Looking at the Looker. To begin unpacking that title, let me begin by saying that there's a famous phrase in linguistics. To know one is to know none. I have found that claim to be true in my experience with studying languages, and perhaps some of you have as well. I had a wonderful language arts teacher in elementary school who required us to do extensive work diagramming sentences. Who had to diagram sentences growing up? I think it's kind of fallen out of vogue, but I'm actually glad that I had to do that. I'd be interested to hear from some of the teachers whether they're still teaching diagramming or not. So I'd say through that diagramming of sentences, I gained a relatively strong grasp of English grammar at a young age. But when I started studying German in high school, it was like the bottom dropped out again. I sort of thought I understood English, and then I found out that it was more complicated than that. And I began to much more clearly perceive the deep structure of the English language when I began comparing it to German, when I had something to understand it in comparison to. So to know one is to know none. Because despite how it can feel from the inside, you've been speaking English all your life, you feel like you know that language really well, it's arguably impossible to know even one language fully unless you have another language to compare and contrast it with. And the more languages you learn and the more you apply the insights of about human evolution and psychology and sociology and other related fields to this phenomenon of human languages, the deeper you begin to understand about the underlying dynamics of all human languages and how that lends insight into the human condition. The same is true, Kripal invites us to consider about religions. To know one is to know none. That you can spend your whole life deeply immersed in a religious tradition, but never see the underlying dynamics that begin to emerge if you begin to compare religious traditions. And Kripal wants to push this process even further to investigate if a robust comparison of all the world's religions, in light of all that we know of 21st century evolution, psychology, neuroscience, sociology, if we might begin to trace the dynamics underneath the human phenomenon of religion. Remember that subtitle of his final chapter, Looking at the Looker. So trying to look back at yourself or that person who's looking at you. And that's from a reference to Matt Toney's book, The Crypto-Terrestrials, where he writes that when he goes to a movie theater, he says, instead of looking at the screen, what I want to do is turn around and look the other way. I want to steal the key to the projectionist booth. And then when everyone has gone home, I want to sneak in. That's what Kripal wants to do with religion. What then is this phenomenon of religion that Kripal wants to look behind the curtain of and perhaps discover, as Dorothy did in Oz, a frail wizard who is all too human? Now, there are many different definitions of religion, but here's one that Kripal invites us to consider that we reflected on during the spoken meditation. The history of religions is humanity's millennia-long struggle and encounter with the anomalous, with the powerful, and with the really, really weird stuff that doesn't make sense. In a sermon back in March, I shared with you some about Kripal's own mystical experiences, how as a, you know, this white Catholic Midwestern boy, you know, doing his PhD at the University of Chicago in the Hindu tradition, he went to India and all of a sudden had some really weird experiences with the goddess Kali, and you can go, I'll link to that sermon if you want to look back into it. But he sought to understand those experiences, both through his academic religious training as well as his training in psychoanalysis. But in addition to the really, really weird stuff that happened to him, what's continued to motivate Kripal to continue working at the intersection of academic rigor, as well as of individual mystical experiences, his own and that of others, is that every time he takes the risk of opening up about his personal experiences, he finds that many people, often those he never would have expected, come up to him in private, many of them other academic PhDs, to share instances of, you know, something really, really weird happened to me one time. Here's just one example. Kripal writes, I was lecturing at a major research university. Afterwards, as always happens to me, a colleague asked me if she could tell me a story. She then proceeded to describe the following series of events. A few years before our conversation, she had sent her 4-year-old son to a petting zoo north of the city with her nanny. At 10:06 a.m., she got a sudden flash of a picture in her head of her son screaming in a car seat, and the car filling up with what looked like white smoke, which she didn't understand. She knew it was a serious car crash because she actually felt viscerally in her own body what she felt like her son was experiencing. She immediately called her nanny. That's why she knew it was at 10:06. They were already at the petting zoo, and she instructed the nanny to come home immediately, drive very slowly and carefully. And they got home fine. The next day, the boy wanted to go back to the petting zoo. He had, after all, not been allowed to stay the day before because his mom freaked out, right? So the mother decided, I will drive him myself this time and be super careful. On the way there, a car made a sharp turn in front of them on the highway, and a crash ensued. Her son was screaming in the back car seat. The airbags deployed. The car filled up with a white smoke coming from the airbags being deployed. The mother turned around to check on her son, and the flash from the day before replayed like a precise video rerun. And the man who hit them offered to call the woman's husband after the crash. Since the woman could not get to her phone, the emergency call registered on her husband's phone at 10:08 a.m. Now, was this woman seeing the future? Or was the future her future self reaching back to her present self? Also note that by acting on her precognitive vision and preventing the child from a full visit to the zoo, the mother actually helped cause that future event to happen, since the child now wanted to return because it had been denied its trip to the zoo. Or did the vision of the future intend a warning, causing her to be more careful and cautious the next day, and maybe the accident was less serious than it might have been otherwise? Now, we can all put our skeptical caps on and begin to try to poke holes in the veracity of this account or other what are called anecdotal evidence, right? And that's frustrating to our scientific types, right? That events like this can't be put into a laboratory and replicated. But Kripal invites us to consider that even science, through Einstein's theory of relativity and through contemporary quantum mechanics, is showing us how space and time are relative to one another, as well as how spookily entangled reality is on the quantum level, what's sometimes called quantum weirdness. Kripal calls this worldview that he's espousing the school of the more, which is an allusion to the turn of the 20th century Harvard psychologist William James and his classic book, The Varieties of Religious Experience, in which James writes about becoming conscious of a higher part of oneself that is coterminous and continuous with a more of the same quality. He doesn't get any more specific with that, just feeling like you're connected to a more of the same quality of yourself, which is operative in the universe outside of oneself. By no means is either James or Kripal saying that they're making a leap from that sort of felt sense that there's a more about the universe than we can rationally prove through the scientific method from there to the existence of God as God has traditionally been presented. Kripal thinks that in all likelihood, reality is much more complex, messy, and in flux than traditional views of God allow. Whatever we mean by God, right? That word has a lot of baggage attached to it, but we don't have time to completely unpack that this morning. But keep in mind what we outlined earlier about the study of linguistics. To know one is to know none. And the title of Kreipal's final chapter, Reflexive Rereadings of Religion, Looking at the Looker. In linguistics, the reflexive case, and I'm about to get just a little bit grammar nerdy, but hang with me, it'll pass soon. In linguistics, the reflexive case refers back to the subject, such as, I help myself to dessert, right? That myself is the reflexive. Or, they saw themselves in the mirror. So it's like a reflex, right? It reflects it back. And I became much more aware of reflexivity in English grammar when I studied German, in which verbs much more frequently take the reflexive case. So in German, you would never say just simply, I'm shaving. You would say, I shave myself. Ich rasiere mich. I'm sure my pronunciation is terrible, but, you know, I've had 5 years of German, but the last of those years was like 1997. So when Kreipal talks about the school of Amor and reflexive rereadings of religion, what he means is that the rational academic study of religion has repeatedly exposed that the sources of religion often point not to some supernatural force out there, but reflexively back to human culture. As Xenophanes said more than 2,500 years ago, way before even Socrates, he wrote, "It is no coincidence that the Ethiopians, who are dark-skinned, worship black gods. And it's no coincidence that the Thracians, who have blonde hair and blue eyes, many of them, worship gods with blue eyes and black hair. If oxen, horses, and lions had religion and hands, they would no doubt paint the gods to look like oxen and horses and lions." But here's where Kreipal sees a 21st century postmodern twist. Even after we pass religion through the skeptical fire of all that we have learned from Feuerbach, and Marx, and Nietzsche, and Freud, and so many others, even after we see all the ways in which religion points less to a God out there and more reflexively back to our own human nature, our human psychology, and our sociology, to how we've evolved, we discover, Kreipal writes, nevertheless, human nature still seems to be something quite extraordinary in itself, perhaps something more. In Kreipal's words, in a reflexive rereading of religion, what people used to see as the angry ghost, you know, Casper, of a poltergeist event, so it's some other being out there, right, is invading us and coming from the outside, might well become the ghost of anger, of parapsychology, the ways in which what's going on inside ourselves manifests itself outside of us, but in ways that often violate the way we think the world is supposed to work, according to reason's rules. From a related perspective, John Caputo, a retired philosophy professor emeritus at Syracuse University, says it this way. I'm interested in opening thinking in practice to the event that is playing itself out underneath the word God. Do you hear that? To the event, to the verb-like phenomenon that is playing itself out underneath what we sometimes call the word God, the sort of noun-like thing that often makes us think of Zeus up in the sky, right? Like the Sistine Chapel, the finger reaching out, the old white dude with a beard, right? It's very problematic for many reasons. Or to extend our linguistic metaphor, he says, the several religions differ from one another in ways that are broadly similar to the ways that languages differ from one another. He writes, there's no more sense to ask what the true religion is than what the true language is. They're different vocabularies, and they're doing different things. But despite these very real differences between different languages and different religions, there's also a shared sameness, because they're also all human languages and human religions. And there are ways in which both reflexively point back to our evolved human nature, even as human language and human religion also in ways point beyond themselves to the ways that we may see that there's more to this universe than we in our finite human condition have the capacity to perceive. As Shakespeare's Hamlet said to the dying Horatio, there are more things in heaven and earth that are dreamt of in your philosophy. Or to take the more contemporary example, the scientist J.B.S. Haldane, as he began to immerse himself into the logic and the meaning of quantum physics, said, the universe is not only queerer than we suppose, it's queerer than we can suppose. For me, the writings of the 20th century Swiss psychiatrist Carl Jung have been among the most helpful I've found for beginning to understand this sort of postmodern perspective on religion. And one of the most helpful metaphors I've found to understand Jung is to imagine our ego, that conscious part of ourselves, to imagine that part of ourselves that we're consciously aware of as ourselves, to imagine that as the tip of an iceberg that is above the surface of the ocean. But equally important, maybe even actually more important, is the rest of the iceberg. The rest, the 90% that's underneath the water, right? What sank the Titanic was not the bit of the iceberg they saw. It was the 90% that they didn't see. And that Jung called, famous break, right? Don't have time to get into that. So Jung said that below the surface, that part of the iceberg that's frozen below the surface, that's our individual unconscious. And the ocean then, of course, it's what he called the collective unconscious. And he wrote that the sea of mind and the being out of which our individual psyche, that is the person that we understand ourselves to be, that, you know, to use this metaphor, when we're alive and at our birth, it freezes over time into a hard form that, you know, that we perceive ourselves and comes into existence at least for a time, and then it melts back into the ocean at our death. And Jung taught that the two best ways he knew of for becoming more conscious of both our individual unconscious, so bringing more of the iceberg above the surface, but also of becoming more aware of the collective unconscious, were what he called paying attention to synchronicities, what he called meaningful coincidences. So he said, pay attention to those synchronicities during the day, and then at night, pay attention to your dreams, when our sort of conscious right brain is asleep and the rest can free associate. An extreme example of synchronicity, of course, is that precognitive event that we talked about earlier, where you had two things happening at 10:06 a.m. And if you're interested in dream work, the easiest way I can tell you for this morning is what's called the TTAQ method, title, theme, affect, question. How many of you at one point or another have paid attention to your dreams, kept a dream journal? Okay, very interesting. I have as well. I had a roommate, I can't really get into this too much, but I had a roommate one time at a conference who was so hardcore about his dream work, he kept a giant glass of water by his bed, and he would chug a glass or two before he went to bed because he wanted to wake up in the middle of the night to record that set of dreams and then go back to sleep and then record. He was really into this. And it helps us set your intention to say, I want to remember my dreams, if those of you have trouble remembering them. And it's important to record them in the first person singular. So don't write about yourself as if you're in the third person. Say, I'm in this room. And all of a sudden, you know, and suddenly the wall opens out and I walk out and then I see. So write it in the first person singular. And then TTAQ is, what title does this dream want itself to have? And don't obsess about that, just, you know, first thing that comes to mind. What themes surface in this dream? What is the affect? So the dominant feeling, were you scared? Were you excited? Were you elated? And finally, instead of asking what leads many people astray, what does this dream mean? And people get obsessed with that. The more helpful question is, what question might this dream be inviting me to ask myself? That can be a much more fruitful way to frame it. For more, I recommend my UU minister colleague Jeremy Taylor's excellent book, The Wisdom of Your Dreams. Now, all that being said, there are modern neuroscientists who strongly argue that our mind is purely local and a material process that blips out when the brain blips out. For those of you who have experienced a taste of the school of the more, I'll end with what Kripal calls the parable of the radio. It's adapted from the neuroscientist David Eagleman's best-selling book, Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. Imagine that you're a Kalahari bushman and that you stumble upon a transistor radio in the sand. You might pick it up and twiddle the knobs, and suddenly, to your surprise, voices are coming out of this box. And now let's say you begin a careful scientific study, as Kalahari bushmen are wont to do, but go with me. A scientific study of what causes the voices. You notice that each time you pull out the green wire, the voices stop. And when you put the wire back into its contacts, the voices begin again. And you come to a clear conclusion. The voices depend entirely on the integrity of the circuitry. That's where the voices come from. And at some point, a young person asks you how some simple loops of electronic signals can engender music and conversations. And you admit that you don't know, but that you're going to find out. And you're going to crack that problem at any moment. But assuming that you are truly isolated, you actually don't know pretty much everything you need to know. Radio waves, electromagnetism, distant cities and that they exist, radio stations, modern civilization. You would not even have the capacity to imagine such things. That's Haldane's The Universe is Queerer Than We Can Suppose. And even if you could, you have no technology to demonstrate the existence of these invisible waves, invisible to humans. And everyone justifiably points out that the onus is on you to convince them. You could convince almost no one, and you'd probably reject the existence of these mysterious waves that might be picking up on these voices outside of this strange box. You would become a radio materialist. There is only this material world. And I'm not asserting that the brain is like a radio, Eagleman says. He's trying to keep his neuroscience, credentials, right? I'm just pointing out that it could be. There's nothing in our current science that rules this out. For Kreipal, this is where the historian of religion steps in. There are, after all, numerous clues in the general history of religions that rule the radio theory in, though hardly prove that the human brain may be some sort of transistor or receiver of consciousness, something like that tip of the iceberg that's drawing from the ocean surrounding it. To the historian of religions, this one or anyone, Kreipal writes, that historian of religion wants to say to the open-minded neuroscientist, looker, look here. As we continue to reflect on these things, I invite you to rise in body or spirit as we sing together hymn 298, Wake Now My Senses.